whether it was possible that whoever had killed Deb was still out there. She felt tears on her face. She remembered Deb, sitting in the chair by the window, but she couldn't tell him about that. She wasn't even sure it was real. I kept going over the case and I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. Malcolm looked thoughtful, and then he stroked her hair again.
You were 17 when it happened, he said. You had questions.
He sighed.
I didn't have the answers, and neither did your mother. We couldn't even answer our own questions.
I'm afraid, Fee, that we left you to deal with all of it alone.
That isn't it.
She was crying now, the sobs coming up through her chest as she heard Deb say, I was so scared. She pressed her face into his checked shirt, smelling his old-school aftershave and the cedar smell of the old drawer he'd pulled his undershirt from.
I should have just left it. I'm just so sorry.
He let her cry for a while, and she felt him drop a kiss to her temple. Well, now, he said, and she heard the grief in his voice, but she also heard Malcolm Sheridan, always Malcolm Sheridan.
That isn't the way I raised you, is it? To leave things be. It's just you and me left, Fee. That isn't how we wanted it, but that's how it is. And you're my daughter.
He let her tears soak into his shirt as her sobbing stopped, and then he spoke again.
Besides, Helen's family never had an arrest, a conviction, like we did. We can fix that. And we will.
He kissed her again.
Get some sleep. We're going to be busy.
She wanted to say something else, but her eyelids felt like sandpaper, and she closed her eyes. Sleep took her before she could speak. The world was disjointed for a while, images passing by like dreams. She had a long, vivid dream of running across the field toward the trees, the dead brush scraping her shins, her breath bursting in her chest as Garrett ran after her. Crows called in the stark sky overhead. Fiona jerked awake over and over, disoriented, before falling back into the same dream again. She had another dream of waking to the sight of her hand in Jamie's, lying on the bed. His hand was bandaged, her fingers curled around it. She was aware of him, could see the familiar, strong bones of his hand, the lines of his forearm, but she did not look up to see his face before falling asleep again. The fever broke sometime the next day, and she sat up in the bed, sweaty and weary, drinking apple juice as the police took her statement. Malcolm sat in the back corner of the room, listening, his sandals on over his socks, his newspaper folded on his lap. She did not hear from Margaret Eden, but she heard from Anthony. When she was well enough to get her cell phone back from her father, "What do you need that thing for?" she answered his call. He told her he was sorry, and he asked if there was anything he could do. She had the beginning of an idea, an itch at the back of her mind, and she asked Anthony a question. The answer he gave her put all the pieces together, and she realized it had been in front of her all along. She had her answers now. She would go to the Idlewild girls as soon as she was well again, but she had a suspicion that they'd come to her first.
Chapter 34. Katie. Barrons, Vermont, April 1951. This was going to work. There was never a doubt in Katie's mind. Still, she could feel the tense anticipation from the other girls in Clayton 3C. Roberta sat in the chair by the window, pretending to study from a textbook. Cece pulled off her uniform and put on her nightgown, even though it was only just past lunchtime. She yanked the pins from her hair and scrubbed her hand through it, making it messy. For her part, Katie straightened her stockings and her skirt. She polished her black shoes to a shine and put them on. She added wadded Kleenex to her bra, then put on her cleanest white blouse, adjusting it so that the fabric stretched just slightly over her enhanced chest.
She pulled a cardigan with the Idlewild crest over the blouse and buttoned it demurely to her neck. Cece pulled off her shoes and stockings, sitting on the edge of the bed.
I really don't know about this, she said.
Her cheeks were pale. Good, Katie thought. That makes it more believable. It was Roberta who answered. Just follow the plan, she said, bending her head to the textbook. In the 5 months since Sonia had disappeared, since she had died, since she had been killed, they all knew she had been killed. Roberta had gone waxy and hard, rarely smiling, never laughing. Her grades didn't falter, and she played better than ever on the hockey field, but the change was clear to Katie. Roberta had taken her grief and her anger and buried it, let it sink into her bones. She looked less like a girl now and more like a grown woman, and she had become fierce. Katie loved her more than ever.
You know I'm no good at these things, Cece said, pushing the covers back on her bed and obediently sliding into it. When Katie cheated on that test, I nearly passed out.
Katie leaned toward the room's only mirror, smoothing and adjusting her hair, and watched the corner of her mouth turn up. Cece always got cold feet, but she always did as well as the rest of them.
You were perfect, she said to Cece, and you know it.
Cece flushed. Praise from Katie always pleased her, even after all this time. Still, she had to whine a little.
This feels like lying.
It isn't lying. Roberta looked up from her book and directed her gaze at Cece, lying in the bed. We talked about this for months. It isn't lying if it's making someone happy, if it's making all of us happy. Cece bit her lip and looked back at Roberta.
Not Katie, she argued. She doesn't get to be happy.
So that was what was bothering her. Katie should have known. She laughed, touched, despite herself.
I'll be happiest of all, she said.
It wasn't a lie, not completely. Her heart was pounding in anticipation and a queer kind of excitement. She was ready. Was that the same as happy? She didn't know, and in this moment she didn't particularly care. She had just turned 16. What mattered was that she got what she wanted. It'll be fine, Roberta said, her voice flat.
If it works, Cece said.
Katie leaned closer to the mirror, smoothing her eyebrows and lightly biting her lips. They weren't allowed makeup at Idlewild, absolutely not, and part of her wished she had some, at least some dark eyeliner and mascara like she'd seen on movie stars, but she was afraid it would look too obvious. She definitely needed to look like a schoolgirl. It'll work, she said. Cece lay back in the bed, pulling the covers up over her ample chest. Katie caught Roberta's gaze in the mirror's reflection, and they traded a look of understanding.
I'm going to do this.
Yes, you are, and we both know why.
It's going to work. I'm going to make it.
Roberta's gaze softened, the lines around her eyes easing, and she smiled at Katie in the mirror. There was a knock on the door.
Ladies! Lady Loon said. It's family visit day. Cecilia, you have a visitor.
Katie smoothed her expression into one of concern and opened the door.
Oh, no, Miss London, she said. Are you sure?
Lady Loon looked frazzled, tendrils of hair escaping from the bun on top of her head.
Of course I'm sure, Katie, she said. What's the matter?
It's just that Cece isn't feeling very well. Katie stepped back, and Lady Loon stepped into the room, looking at Cece on the bed. Cece moaned a little. She looked positively green, probably from terror, which added to the effect.
"What's the matter?"
Lady Loon asked her.
"Oh," Cece said, licking her lips as if they were dry. "It's my stomach, Miss London. Is it my father who has come to see me?"
Lady Loon clenched her hands, her knuckles going white.
No, it's your brother, I believe.
She hated saying the words, Katie could see, keeping her face straight. Lady Loon did not like referring to Cece's bastard status or her brother's, which was what they wanted.
Oh, no, Cece groaned quite believably. He came all this way. I can't. I just can't.
It's very rude to turn him away, Roberta commented calmly from over her textbook. Can you talk to him, Miss London? Lady Loon's eyes went wide. She looked positively horrified.
Me? Ladies, I'm certainly not going to talk to that man.
An illegitimate bastard, she didn't say.
He came so far, Cece wailed again.
Maybe one of us can go, Roberta said.
Maybe,
Katie said, as if this had just occurred to her.
Roberta, why don't you go?
Roberta frowned. I have a Latin test tomorrow, and I need to study. Katie rolled her eyes.
Oh, please, why study?
That made Lady Loon jump, just as it was supposed to.
Of course she needs to study, Katie Winthrop, she said sharply. And since you seem to be at leisure, you are to go speak to Cecilia's brother immediately and explain the situation to him.
Me?
Katie put out her lip just a little, petulant.
I don't want to go.
You'll do as you're told, young lady. Now go.
Katie huffed a put-upon sigh and stomped out of the room. She didn't look back. He was sitting at a table in the dining hall, waiting. Before he noticed her, Katie took stock. He was 21, according to Cece. Dark hair slicked back, nice suit, pressed shirt, a narrow face, gray eyes. He sat politely, no fidgeting. His hands were folded on the table in front of him, and she saw that they were elegant and masculine, the fingers long, the knuckles well-formed. Nice hands, she thought, gathering her courage. I can deal with a man with nice hands. She glanced to see that no one was looking. Then she folded the waist of her skirt with a quick twist of her wrist, making the length climb an inch above her knees, and then another. She unbuttoned the Idlewild cardigan but didn't take it off, letting it fall open just so that he would be able to glimpse the stretched blouse beneath. Then she squared her shoulders and walked toward him. He was expecting Cece, so it took him a moment to realize she was coming his way, that she was heading for him. He lifted his chin and looked at her and froze perfectly still. Katie blinked her tilted, long-lashed eyes at him and smiled, sweet and knowing at the same time. Abashed, as if he was having an effect on her, yet she didn't quite want it to show. Joseph Eden watched her come toward him, and his eyes went wide, his jaw dropping open just a little as he watched her thighs move beneath the hem of her skirt.
"Hi there,"
Katie said to him, pulling up a chair and sitting across from him.
"You," he stopped and cleared his throat. "You're not Cece," he managed.
She smiled at him again.
"No, I'm not. I'm her roommate. She's not feeling well today, but she felt terrible that you came all this way, so she sent me instead."
She held out her hand and leaned across the table, letting the cardigan fall open just the right way. "My name's Katie," she said. "Katie Winthrop." When he shook her hand in his bigger one, nice hands, she reminded herself. She squeezed it and leaned forward across the table. Now he'd have a hint of cleavage hidden in the shadows of her sweater and her blouse. "I have to confess, I've always wanted to meet you," she said, lowering her voice conspiratorially. He blinked.
"Me?"
"Cece talks about you so much." Katie let a dreamy look cross her expression. "Her wonderful brother. We're all dying of curiosity." She lowered her voice again. "Especially me." He caught her gaze, and she saw the second his shoulders relaxed. He smiled, hooked, but not quite reeled in. Not yet.
"Well, I'm Joseph," he said. "Joseph Eden. It sure is nice of you to come and keep me company if Cece isn't feeling well. I did come a long way."
She let his hand go and smiled again. He had a nice enough smile, lovely hands, and a good suit. And he wasn't legitimate, but he was Brad Ellesmere's only son and would someday be his heir. Katie was counting on it. You make your own fate, she thought. You build it every day. This is how it begins. Well then, she said to Joseph Eden, we have some time to kill before you go all the way home again. I think we can entertain each other, don't you?
Chapter 35 Barrons, Vermont, November 2014. She had made her full statement to the police, and the doctors gave her permission to go home, so Fiona pulled clothes from the overnight bag Malcolm had brought for her and spent 45 minutes putting them on, slowly pulling on underwear, jeans, a t-shirt, and a zip-up hoodie. The fever had broken, but she was still woozy and tired, her muscles made of melted butter. She put on socks and walked to the bathroom adjoining her hospital room, washing up the best she could. Her face in the mirror was ghostly, her skin waxen, shadows under her eyes. Her red hair looked stark under the fluorescent lights and against the pallor of her skin. She tucked it behind her ears and looked down into the sink again. When she was finished, she walked to the bathroom door and stopped. A woman stood in her hospital room, small of stature but straight of posture, thick white hair cut short and curled. She wore a wool coat, belted at the waist, her hands in the large pockets. When Fiona made a noise in the bathroom doorway, she turned and looked at her, one eyebrow raised. It was Margaret Eden. Fiona stared at her. She was lightheaded. This felt a little surreal. She said, "What are you doing here?"
"I came to see you," Margaret said.
Even in her ill state, Fiona didn't think for a second that Margaret Eden was concerned about her health.
Why? She asked.
Margaret stayed where she was, hands in the pockets of her expensive coat, and waited. Finally, she said, Fiona, do we have something to talk about? Fiona stepped farther into the room, steadying herself on the door jamb.
I know who you are, she said. Who you really are.
Do you? The older woman seemed curious, but unconcerned.
Yes.
Fiona felt her fingers go slick against the door, cold sweat on her palms.
You're Katie Winthrop.
She hadn't known what to expect, but it wasn't the smile that spread over Margaret Eden's face, her features relaxing. Margaret turned her chin, directing her words back over her shoulder.
Girls, she said.
She knows.
Two other women came into the room. One was Roberta Green, tall and stately, her features composed. The other, the same age as Katie and Roberta, was shorter and rounder, her eyes kind and her hair cropped close to her head. Cece Frank, Fiona thought to herself, or whatever her name is now.
It's nice to meet you, honey, Cece said, taking Fiona's hand and squeezing it.
Oh, sit down. Katie, she's still ill. Cece sighed and looked in Fiona's eyes.
She forgets about people's feelings sometimes.
Fiona turned to stare at Katie again.
The first time we met, you told me you'd never been a student at Idlewild.
Katie shrugged. I lied, she said. I do that sometimes, when I have to. How did you figure out it was me?
I've seen your Idlewild file. It has your full name, Catherine Margaret Winthrop. It didn't click at first, but I asked your son what your maiden name was, and when he said Winthrop, I knew.
That made Katie laugh. All right, it isn't a state secret. I just don't make my past public, that's all.
How did you do it?
Fiona asked Katie, walking to the edge of the bed and lowering herself.
How did you change your name? And why?
Katie still stood, her hands in her pockets. Beauty, but not the wholesome kind, Sarah London had said of Katie Winthrop in 1950.
She was a discipline problem from the day she arrived until the day she left. She looked down at Fiona where she sat on the bed, and in the arched brows and the determined set of her jaw, Fiona could see that girl from 64 years ago. "Well, I married Joseph Eden, for one," she said. "I didn't want to be Katie anymore. I wanted to leave everything behind. My family, Idlewild, not the girls, of course, but the rest of it, yes. My parents had always treated me like an embarrassment, and as Joseph's wife, I could forget about them entirely. I was young, and I thought I could start new. I told Joseph I'd always hated the name Katie, and that I wanted to be called by my middle name, Margaret, instead. I told him I wanted to leave that old wayward girl behind and start a new life as his wife. She shrugged. He agreed. "Who was Joseph Eden?" Fiona asked. "He was my brother," Cece supplied. She pulled up a chair and sat on it, facing Fiona, as if they were going to have a chat. Katie stayed standing, and Roberta had walked to the window, where she listened as she looked out. "My half-brother, that is. We had the same father." "Brad Elsmere," Fiona said. Cece blinked. "Is that in my file?" "Never mind what's in the file," Fiona said. "Katie married your father's illegitimate son?" "His heir." This was Roberta, speaking from her place by the window. Her voice was low, commanding, and they all looked at her. "He was Brad Elsmere's illegitimate son, but he was also his only son. Brad Elsmere put him in the will. He was the Elsmere heir."
"I see." "You think it's cold," Katie said. "I can see it in your face, Fiona. You think it makes me a manipulative bitch. I was 16 when I met Joseph, though he waited until I was 18 to marry me. I was 16, and I needed to make my own life by whatever means I had." Fiona swallowed. "I'm not judging you."
"Aren't you?"
"You're right. I married him because I thought he'd be useful, because I was cold and angry. But do you know what? I ended up liking him. I made him happy. I never thought I'd make anyone happy. We were together for nearly 60 years, and we got along just fine. Not many married couples can say as much." She smiled. "Joseph got me out of Idlewild, away from my family, away from everything. I used his money to send Roberta to law school so she could help her uncle. I used his money to send Cece to Vassar so she could get away from her horrible mother, so she could stay away from that woman. My mother was Brad Elsmere's housekeeper," Cece explained. "Having his illegitimate child was a burden to her. It was harder in those days. There was so much shame. She tried to drown me in the ocean when I was 6. She rubbed a finger lightly over her lower lip. "She really wasn't stable," she said, her voice almost gentle. "My father sent her for treatment after she tried to kill me, but she checked herself out and left. I went to college and became a teacher, so I wouldn't have to go home."
"You're a teacher?" Fiona asked.
"Oh, no, not anymore." Cece dropped her hand. "I quit once I got married and had children. I'd achieved what I wanted, and I was better at being a mother anyway. I preferred to raise my kids. Katie howled at me, I can tell you, but that was the one time she lost an argument with me." "Cece always did want children."
Katie was still standing, looking down, watching as Fiona tried to follow the conversation. This was how the girls talked, it seemed, finishing one another's sentences, completing one another's thoughts after so many years. "Cece was a better mother than any of us, I think," Roberta said from her place by the window.
"That's true," Katie said. She had been beautiful once. Fiona could see that now. She was still beautiful.
Katie glanced down at Cece, and Fiona saw the complicated love in the look. "Without that degree, you would have married some country bumpkin at 18, not an engineer at 27. Cece reached over, and to Fiona's surprise, took Katie's hand in hers and held it tightly.
"She got us out of there," she said to Fiona, still holding her friend's hand. "All three of us, away from our families, our pasts. Katie set us free."
"That wasn't all of it, though," Roberta said. She was watching them, leaning casually against the window. There was always a bigger plan behind that one, a bigger goal.
Sonia, Fiona said, you wanted to find who killed your friend.
The police wouldn't investigate, Cece explained. That was my fault. I told the headmistress that Sonia had been at Ravensbrook when I tried to explain she couldn't have run away. I was so innocent. I had no idea that would make everyone assume she was a Jew, that it would make the investigation less important, not more. But they asked a few questions, looked in the woods for an hour or two, and filed it away. It was over.
With money, Katie explained, her voice soft, we at least could investigate the matter ourselves. She pulled up a chair at last and sat next to Cece, crossing her legs elegantly.
I hired private investigators over the years to go over the evidence, but never with any results. The school was still open, and they wouldn't give permission for my investigators to search the grounds. They claimed it was an old case of a runaway girl, and there was no cause. When the school closed, I begged Joseph to buy it, but unfortunately that was the one time he said no to me. He said the land was a terrible investment, and he'd lose his shirt. He wasn't willing to lose that much money to satisfy a whim of mine. She smiled at Fiona.
But we did solve it in the end. Ourselves. I'll tell you freely if you want. Would you like to know who Sonia's murderer was?
It was the temptation, the same one that had lured her into this case, that had nearly gotten her killed. Katie Winthrop, Fiona realized, was very adept at playing off the expectations of whomever she was talking to.
I already know, Fiona said to her, though when I first looked at it, the most likely suspects were you three.
She glanced around at them. You had access to her, and you certainly had the opportunity. Sonia was killed by something blunt to the head, not a weapon. It was a crime of opportunity, of someone who hated her, seeing their chance and getting rid of her.
The women were quiet. Katie looked amused. Roberta stared out the window, her jaw set. Cece's eyes were wide.
But I never liked that theory, Fiona went on. The account I heard was that you were friends with her, that you liked her. Roberta brought her to the school nurse a few weeks before she was killed.
That made Roberta turn her head. She had a fit in the garden, she said. It made her think of the digging detail at Ravensbrook. A flashback, though that term wasn't in use at the time. Sonia almost certainly had some form of PTSD. She nearly passed out.
Fiona nodded.
You cared about her.
It could have been a lie, but when you talked about her when we met, it didn't seem like it.
I should have just assumed that one of you did it and moved on.
But you didn't, did you? Katie asked softly. How terribly clever.
No, I didn't. I followed another lead.
She met Katie's gaze.
I don't know how you did it, but I have the feeling that what I found won't be a surprise to you at all.
You won't know unless you tell us, will you? Katie said.
I did some research, Fiona said. I learned about a woman named Rose Albert, also known as Rosa Berlitz.
There was a long, drawn-out minute of silence. Fiona could hear her own breathing, the beeps of machines in rooms down the hall, the clatter of someone walking by dragging an IV stand. Nurses talked and laughed quietly behind the door of her room. The four of them were still. Roberta still looked out the window, but Katie and Cece watched Fiona.
Well, Katie sat back in her chair and pressed her hands together. Her features were composed, even amused, but Fiona still had the feeling she'd impressed the older woman for the first time today.
This is interesting.
How did you do it? Cece blurted. She looked like she could barely contain herself. You never saw the picture.
What picture? Fiona asked.
Sonia's drawing, in her notebook.
Cece glanced at Katie, who was giving her an icy look, and made an impatient sound.
Leave it, Katie. She already knows. Why not tell her about the book?
Cece turned back to Fiona.
Sonia had a notebook. I gave it to her, actually. It had been a present to me, but I never used it. Sonia took it and wrote in it.
all of her memories, and she drew pictures of her family, of Ravensbrook, of the people she knew there. The notebook was in her suitcase when she disappeared.
The suitcase that was taken from the headmistress's office? Fiona asked.
Cece ignored another dirty look from Katie.
We took it, of course. We wanted Sonia's things back. They didn't belong in some dusty old closet, and we thought it might hold a clue, so we took it. But we never found a clue in there. Not until 1973.
That was the year of Rosa Berlitz's trial, Fiona said. The year Rosa died.
A heart attack in her own home, the papers had said. From her place in the window, Roberta chimed in.
I had a baby in 1973, she said. My son. I didn't hear about the Berlitz trial. But when I came back to work at the firm, people were talking about it. My firm hadn't handled the case, but it was a landmark in local legal circles. I heard the word Ravensbrook, and I started to wonder.
She turned and faced Fiona, the harsh light from the window illuminating her still perfect skin.
I dug up the articles about the trial, a war crimes trial, and it wasn't even front page news.
Fiona nodded. That's what she'd seen as well.
I made copies of the articles and mailed them to Katie and Cece, Roberta went on. I asked them if they thought it might have some bearing on Sonia, since Rosa Berlitz had lived in Burlington. It was just too much of a coincidence that she and Sonia had been close enough to cross paths, but I'm sure you thought the same thing already.
It was me who figured it out, Cece said. I saw the photo from the newspaper and I recognized her immediately. I was the one who kept Sonia's suitcase, you see, with the notebook in it. We'd all read the notebook, but I'd read it many times over. And the minute I saw Rosa Berlitz, I recognized her face. Sonia had drawn a portrait of her from memory. Rosa had been a Ravensbrook guard.
Wait, Fiona said.
Rosa Berlitz was acquitted.
You're saying you had evidence of her identity and you didn't go to the authorities with it?
We would have gone to the authorities, Katie said quietly. But we didn't have time. We went to Rosa first.
All of us, Roberta said.
We went right to her house, Cece added. Knocked on the door, and there she was.
I have to say, Katie said, she really wasn't expecting us. She wasn't an old woman, but she was a recluse, especially since the trial. She was not well. She shook her head. Not well at all.
Fiona found that she was gripping the edge of the bed so hard her knuckles were white.
What did you do? She said. The obituary said she died of a heart attack.
What did you do?
Katie smiled at her.
We asked her questions about Ravensbrook, about Sonia, about everything. She shrugged.
She didn't want to admit anything at first, but we were persistent, and Roberta has a lot of experience with witnesses on the stand in court. She was magnificent. I suppose you could say we bullied Rose a little bit, but that's a matter of opinion, isn't it? In any case, we made her believe that it was over, that we already knew everything there was to know. We made her believe she could be indicted not only for the Ravensbrook crimes, but for Sonia's murder as well. She looked sick. She wasn't well, as I say. And then she started to talk.
She admitted to it? Fiona asked.
Yes, Roberta said. Her voice was bitter. She knew where Sonia was going from her bus ticket. Sonia had changed the ticket at her agency. She went to the stop in her car, parked, and waited. When Sonia got off the bus, she followed her into the woods and killed her with a rotted beam from the old fence. Then she dumped the body, walked back to her car, and drove away. She was very, very sorry.
That dried-up old Nazi bitch, Katie said darkly.
Yes, she was, Cece added. She wouldn't tell us where she'd dumped the body, because she knew that would seal her case. It was her word against ours, and once a body was recovered, it was over. But we weren't leaving. We asked and asked. We were so angry after all these years. She got agitated.
Fiona had to ask it. Did you kill her?
It was Katie who answered that one.
Did you think we killed her? She asked. What a picture that paints.
All of us standing over her, choking her, suffocating her, perhaps, in revenge. The coroner misdiagnosing it as a heart attack. The three of us sending Sonia's killer to hell. She nodded. I like it. That isn't how it happened. But I can't say I find the picture distasteful.
No, we didn't kill her, Roberta added. She had a heart attack, a real one, while we were there, asking over and over where we could find Sonia's body. I think the fear and the stress just overpowered her. She fell on the floor. We thought she was faking at first, but she wasn't. She really was dying.
It was a disaster, Cece said. She was the only one who knew where Sonia was buried. I was so upset. Fiona stared at her. So what did you do?
She died, Katie said, her voice cold and sharp.
We left. That was all.
You just left her there?
Roberta snorted, the most unladylike sound Fiona had ever heard the older woman make. But it was Katie who answered.
If that piece of Nazi garbage had killed your sister, she said, and then spent decades living free while she rotted in a well, what would you do?
The room was quiet. Fiona couldn't answer. Katie Winthrop rose from her chair and touched Fiona on the shoulder.
I'm not a bad person, she said. None of us are. But this was Sonia's killer. We'd spent our lives trying to find her when no one cared, when the police stopped looking. I think, of all people, you would understand.
Jesus, Fiona breathed.
You see what we were up against, Katie said. We had to be hard. We've always had to be hard. It was either that or break.
I have one more question, Fiona said.
Go ahead, Katie said. You've earned it.
Idlewild.
Fiona made herself say the word.
The restoration. Was it ever real?
Katie shook her head, giving her the truth.
I bought Idlewild because I knew Sonia was buried there somewhere, she said. She had to be there. I intended to go over every inch and find her. Anthony never knew. He just thought I was misguided. He disapproved from the first, just like his father did. But that was because he didn't know what I really wanted.
And now you've found Sonia, Fiona said.
I have, Katie said softly. I'm going to give her a proper burial. And then, my dear, you can rest easy. I'm not going to restore Idlewild. I'm going to take that place with all of its ghosts, and I'm going to bury it. I'm going to dismantle every stick and stone until there's nothing left, and then I'm going to leave it to rot, just like it wants to.
Chapter 36 Barrons, Vermont, December 2014. Fiona stayed at her father's house her first night out of the hospital, on the twin bed that was still in her old bedroom, and then she went home. She was shaky and tired, but the worst of the flu was over, and her neck was beginning to heal. She went back to her small apartment, laden with groceries from Malcolm, and looked around at the stacks of boxes from Idlewild Hall. Then she went to bed. She thought maybe she'd stay there, that maybe she'd run out of whatever had driven her for the last 20 years, and without it she had nothing left. The jittery feeling she always got in her bloodstream was gone, and she thought she'd sleep for a week. But instead she stared at the ceiling, her mind ticking over, more slowly, more deliberately than it used to, but ticking all the same. Within an hour she was up again, wearing old boxers and a stretched-out T-shirt, eating crackers and canned soup, her feet up on a box of Idlewild records. She pulled out her laptop after a while and checked her email. There was a small avalanche in her inbox. Jonas hoping she was okay. Journalists from the local press covering the story of Garrett Creel's arrest and looking for a statement. Hester, one of the sisters from the Barrons Historical Society, sending her links to the story in the local press. There was nothing from Jamie. It was mid-morning, quiet in her apartment building, most of the residents gone to work. Fiona clicked on the links Hester had sent her and scanned through the news stories.
Garrett Creel had been charged with kidnapping and attempted murder for his attack on her, as well as firing at a police officer who happened to be his own son. He was scheduled for a bail hearing the next day. The articles on the newswire gave a brief summary of Fiona's background, of Deb's murder and Tim's conviction, of the fact that Fiona was dating Garrett's son, but no motive for the attack was given. And there was no mention of Garrett Creel covering up evidence of Tim's crimes and the murder of Deb in 1994. It wasn't completely surprising. The police would keep the internal investigation under wraps for as long as they could. There were always potential leaks in internal police cases, but it took a diligent journalist to dig them out. This story was a small one. A retired chief of police attacking a 37-year-old woman and trying to choke her to death. A family dispute. Even a lover's quarrel, maybe. Something seedy. She set aside the requests from the journalists in her inbox without answering them. She would decide whom to talk to and when. She picked up her cell phone, stared at its string of notifications, and suddenly felt tired. She wished Jamie was here. He hadn't texted. He hadn't called. He'd been at the hospital. She hadn't imagined that. She wondered what he was doing, how he was taking his father's arrest. She pictured that cozy, time-warped house without Garrett in it, Diane knocking around it by herself. As she was staring at her phone, it rang in her hand, an unknown number. On impulse, she answered it. "Hello, Fiona," came the rich, familiar voice of an elderly woman on the other end. Fiona felt her stomach tighten. "Hello, Katie." Katie Winthrop sighed. "No one ever calls me that," she said, "except Roberta and Cece. And now you. The hospital tells me you were released. How are you feeling?" "Fine, I suppose. I just talked to Anthony. He's suspicious that something is up. He asked me why in the world you wanted to know my maiden name." "Then you should tell him the truth, don't you think?" "I just might," Katie said. "I'm old enough now. I'm tired of being Margaret. I think it's time to be Katie again. But that isn't what I'm calling about. I'm calling about the Idlewild files." By reflex, Fiona stared around her darkened apartment at the files stacked against the walls. "Anthony already tried," she said. "Yes, he did. Now I'm going to try and bargain with you. I want the files. I already own the school and the property. I want the files, too." "What for?" "Because it's my history," Katie said. "It's our history, me and the girls, Sonia's history. And maybe I'm a maudlin old lady, but I think it might have answers." "It's a bunch of old textbooks and personnel files," Fiona said. "I don't think you're going to find the answer you want." "Then I'll be disappointed, I suppose, but I'm willing to make an offer," Katie said. "What do you want, Fiona?" Fiona stared down at her bare legs, her bare feet, as the words echoed home. "What do you want, Fiona?" She wanted all of this to be over. She wanted to be different. She wanted her life to be different. She wanted the chance to do it all over again. She wanted money. A career that felt real. She wanted Jamie back. But what she said was, "I want Sonia's diary." There was icy silence on the other end of the line. "You thought I'd ask for money, didn't you?" Fiona said. "I suppose everyone asks you for money. But that's not what I want from you." "What exactly do you want with the diary?" Katie asked. "There's a historian in the UK who is writing about Ravensbrück," Fiona said. "The records from the camp were burned before the Soviet army liberated it. The survivors' histories are few. She's trying to put the pieces together, to tell the story. Sonia's diary would add to the history." "I'm willing to consider it," Katie said. "I'll ask the girls, but we aren't prepared to give the diary away permanently. We'll lend it or give a copy. But we are in that diary. She drew all of us. It's personal to us. I think she can work with that." "I'm burying her, you know," Katie said. "Sonia.
Now that the coroner is done with her and she has no relatives, I've asked that she be released to me. I'm going to have her properly buried in Barron's Memorial Cemetery with a headstone. There'll be a small ceremony next week if you'd like to come.
I will, Fiona said.
And I'm still going to write the story about the case, about her disappearance and the discovery of the body.
I see, Katie said.
And will your story mention Rosa Berlitz?
It might.
It would. Of course it would. Whom did she think she was dealing with?
Do your worst, Katie said, resigned. I'm old now. I have lawyers.
I will. Thanks.
And there's one more thing.
What is it?
Fiona reached into one of the file boxes and pulled out the file in which Lila Hendrickson, Idlewild's history teacher, had put together the map of the Hand House and the church before Idlewild was built. When you get the files, there's one in particular you'll want to read. It's the history of Mary Hand, the real Mary Hand. She was an actual person, and her house was on the Idlewild grounds before the school was. There was another cold silence, but this one was tinged with fear.
My God, Katie said. Is she buried there?
With her baby, yes, Fiona said.
She's in the garden, isn't she?
Katie was excited now. She didn't wait for a reply before she said, I knew it, that damned garden.
Well, it's my garden now, which makes her mine, too. I'm calling the girls.
Katie,
I'll take care of it, Katie said, and hung up.
Chapter 37 Barron's, Vermont, December 2014. The Barron's police headquarters looked the same as it always had, squat and industrial. Fiona crunched through the icy crust of last night's snow through the parking lot and up the walk to the front door. She passed the picnic table where she'd sat the first day she'd told Jamie about the Idlewild story. Christmas was a few weeks away, and someone had pulled out the department's box of wilted decorations. A too-short garland made of tinsel sagged over the door when Fiona walked through, and a small plastic Christmas tree topped with a Snoopy sat on the dispatch desk. The old cop on dispatch looked up and nodded at Fiona as she came through the door.
Back interview room, he said. The chief's waiting for you.
Fiona tasted copper in the back of her throat at the words, the chief's waiting for you. It wasn't Garrett Creel. It was Barron's current police chief, Jim Pfeiffer. Still, she wasn't quite used to hearing those words. She nodded and kept walking. The open office had a low hum of activity that went quiet as she passed. Jamie's desk was empty, his coat gone, his computer off. Jamie was on leave while his father's case moved through the system. People watched her as she walked by. This was the effect of being the person Barron's beloved longtime police chief had assaulted and nearly killed, the person that had caused his fall from grace. She kept her gaze forward and walked back to the station's interview room. Jim Pfeiffer was 50, fit and vigorous, unremarkable except for the black-framed glasses he wore that made him look more like an engineer from 1960s NASA than a modern-day cop. He shook Fiona's hand and offered to take her coat before he closed the door of the interview room.
"Sit down," he said, not unkindly. "I thought we should talk in private."
Fiona sat. "I already gave my statement," she said. "Several times, actually."
"Yes, I'm aware," Pfeiffer said. "There are a few other things I'd like to go over." He smiled. "First of all, how are you doing?"
Fiona smiled tightly back at him.
"I'm just great, thanks. Your entire force hates me because your former boss tried to kill me, but that's okay. I sleep great at night knowing he's out on bail."
Pfeiffer leaned back in his chair.
"That's how the system works, Fiona. The judge made a ruling."
A judge who was one of Garrett's golf buddies, likely. But Fiona kept quiet.
"We've been getting some calls from the media," Pfeiffer said. "Chief Creel's arrest was public record, but I've been fielding inquiries that contain inside information."
He stared at her from behind his glasses. Specifically, we've been getting calls about a case from 1993, the assault of a girl named Helen Heyer. There seems to be some belief starting up that the Heyer case has to do with Tim Christopher.
Is that so? Fiona asked. Pfeiffer sighed.
Please, Fiona, drop the act. We all know the Heyer case was one of your crazy theories before all of this happened.
Yes, of course, Fiona said. I had a crazy theory, and Garrett tried to kill me to shut me up, but my theory is crazy, sure thing.
It will go through the standard channels of investigation, Pfeiffer said, the exact phrase he'd used at the press conference. But we don't appreciate media muckraking over this.
Then talk to the media who are doing the muckraking, not me.
Except it is you, Pfeiffer said. It isn't you making the calls, but it's you feeding them. Please don't insult me by suggesting otherwise.
Fiona stared down at her hands and said nothing. She'd known from the first that none of it would be followed up properly. Not Garrett's cover-up of Tim's assault on Helen Heyer. Not Garrett's attempts to cover Deb's murder. Her father had raised a journalist, not a fool. So she'd called Patrick Saller, the journalist who had written the original article about Deb's murder for Lively Vermont in 1994. Patrick was freelancing now, and Fiona had offered him everything she knew about the police corruption case that was about to unfold. A case that tied back to Deb's murder, to the piece Patrick had written, even back to the interview he'd done with Richard Rush, in which he'd stated that Tim Christopher had eaten ice cream in his shop at 9 o'clock. Saller had remembered every detail of the case, and of his own piece, and had jumped on the lead. But she wasn't telling Pfeiffer that.
Okay, Fiona said. You'd like the media to leave you alone. Anything else?
Pfeiffer shook his head.
I'm not getting through to you, am I?
Like I said, you need to talk to the reporters who are calling you, not me.
There's a web page, Pfeiffer argued. It's called the Tim Christopher Truth Page. There's a bunch of garbage on there about police misconduct on these two cases. Christopher's lawyer has caught wind of it. He says he might sue.
Interesting, Fiona said. You can't sue someone you can't find, she thought.
There are social media pages. There's some hippie lawyer involved, working pro bono. Someone's made a podcast. Fiona, this is crazy.
Well, there are a lot of crazy people out there, Fiona agreed. None of them are me. Now he was angry.
It's you and your father, and you know it.
Fiona suppressed a smile. Malcolm might not have known much about modern technology, and he couldn't have made a web page or a Facebook post to save his life, but it didn't matter. Malcolm knew everyone. No one could muster the right people to get a message out more quickly or in a more sophisticated way than Malcolm Sheridan. He had Patrick Saller on his side, as well as a retired civil rights lawyer from his Vietnam days. He also had the support of Jonas Cooper, Fiona's editor at Lively Vermont, who knew a few tech geeks from the local community college. And when it came to exposing the attempted cover-up of his daughter's murder, Malcolm was both connected and motivated. Lighting a fire under the cops was his God-given talent.
I wouldn't care about all of this, Pfeiffer said. People post shit on the internet all the time. My problem is that yesterday I got a call from BCI. They're opening an internal investigation into Garrett Creel and four of my other cops for criminal misconduct.
Fiona tried not to show her shock. That was new to her. She didn't think even Malcolm had any sway with the state police's Bureau of Criminal Investigation. That was why they'd come up with the internet campaign.
This is just the start, Pfeiffer said.
He had a head of steam now.
There will be more names. I'll have to put more guys on leave, which makes me understaffed. I have to pay for overtime, which shoots my budget to hell. Morale is going to be a problem. I'm hardly swamped with recruits here. I still have to get up every morning and work in this community.
And this is my fault? Fiona said. He covered for my sister's killer. And then he tried to fucking kill me.
I get it. I do. It makes me mad. But I have to catch the next Tim Christopher who comes along.
Then your cops shouldn't have tried to cover for the first one. Fiona pushed back her chair. We're done.
Call off your dogs, Fiona, Pfeiffer said.
I told you, they're not mine.
Just answer me one question.
What is it? She asked.
I read your statement. You say Garrett told Tim to dump the body in the woods, to buy time before it was found. Yet Tim dumped it in the field. His words, according to you, were he dropped it and ran. Pfeiffer paused. That doesn't seem to fit, does it? Tim was cool enough to call Garrett that night, cool enough to go along with the plan.
He looked at Fiona through the lenses of his glasses, and she could see he hadn't missed a detail of this case.
Why do you think he botched it up so badly? Why did he lose his nerve?
Fiona had actually thought about this. It was true the facts didn't fit, unless you remembered that this was Idlewild. I think something scared him, she said. I think he dumped her and ran because he was afraid. Pfeiffer's brows rose.
Tim Christopher was so scared he ran?
Yes.
What could scare him that badly?
She'd thought about this, too, laying awake wondering about it, actually. What had Mary Hand shown him? What sights? What sounds? Tim Christopher, a murderer. What had she reached into his mind and shown him that was so frightening he'd dropped Deb's body and run? She shook her head at Pfeiffer. We'll never know, she said. But I really hope it was horrible. Her breath puffed before her as she walked away from the station. When she rounded the corner of the building, heading for the parking lot, she stopped when she saw the figure leaning against her car. Her heart pounded, and suddenly she felt lightheaded, as if the sudden jolt of happiness could make her fly away. Jamie, she said. He moved off where he'd been leaning and stood straight, his hands in the pockets of his coat. The cold wind tousled his hair. He looked paler than he had the last time she'd seen him, but his vitality hadn't dimmed, and he held her gaze with his own, his look dark and worried.
Hey, he said.
He cleared his throat, looking her over.
Are you okay?
She was quietly, surprisingly elated to see him. What should have felt complicated suddenly didn't feel complicated to her at all, but Jamie was tense, his posture hard. Sure, she managed. I'm fine now. How are you?
All right, I guess,
he said.
I saw your car by accident. It was an impulse. I guess I can't stay away from this place. I'm not stalking you.
Good to know. He glanced past her to the station.
You've been to see Pfeiffer?
I was summoned. Fiona crossed her arms. He's pissed about the BCI investigation. He blames it on me. But I think he's going to figure out pretty quickly who's behind it. He looked at her for a long moment, and she watched the wariness drain from his expression like water.
I didn't instigate it. Given what's happened, they opened the investigation themselves. But I'm cooperating, Fee. I'm giving them everything I know.
About your own father? She asked gently.
He covered for Tim. He tried to kill you. He shot at me.
Jamie shook his head.
But I told you before all of that. I was already done. And I meant it.
He gave her the ghost of a smile.
I guess it's safe to say I'm not going to be a cop anymore.
So what will you do?
I don't know. I'll have to think of something. Maybe I'll take up woodworking, or buy an apple orchard.
He took his hands out of his pockets, and she saw the bandage on his hand.
I hear journalism is a particularly lucrative career, except I can't write for shit.
That made her laugh, the sound brief before it died again. He didn't have to be a cop to do good, to help people. Maybe in time he'd realize that. Jesus, Jamie, she said, rubbing a hand over her forehead. What a mess. How is your mother handling it?
Not good,
he said, looking grim. He glanced at her.
She blames you, at least for now.
Of course she did. She was a cop's wife, a cop's mother.
His mother hates me, and his father tried to kill me, Fiona thought. This is never going to work. As if reading her mind, Jamie said,
So what now, Fee?
She looked around at the cold, empty street, beneath gray skies that threatened more snow, at the police station behind her,